Well, the Big Bang is really great. That's really cool. I guess I'll move the mic over. Right, the reviews have been good. But before I say anything about the book, I want to say something about the bookstore. And I want to thank folks, Kelsey and Carrie, for inviting us here to Skylight. You know, a bookstore, an independent community bookstore is an extremely important thing. And I'm so glad that you could come and join with me today at this bookstore. To me, bookstores, independent bookstores in today's world is part of the, in the case of L.A., all over, but in the case of L.A., it's part of the intellectual infrastructure of L.A. It's a very important part. It's a part where people can come together, where people can peruse books, where they can share ideas, when they have a certain common space that brings them together, all different types of people. And independent bookstores in the age of Amazon is extremely important. And now that Amazon is starting their own brick-and-mortar bookstores, it's even more important for us to have a clearer sense of what the value of these stores are. And I have to say, you know, it's not solely just because I really like Skylight Books, which I do, but it's because I bought a bookstore myself last year because it's the bookstore that I always go to, and it was going out of business, and the owner was 93, it no longer had inventory, and it was the oldest independent bookstore in Los Angeles. And a friend of mine, we were on Larchmont Boulevard, and I said, I'm going to the bookstore to buy a book, but I know they won't have it because they don't have any more inventory, hardly. And they'll order it, and maybe it will come, and maybe it won't. And he said, yeah, we should buy it. And I said, yeah, right. But then I thought about it, and I decided to do it. And Bert and I bought it, and I've owned it for a year, and I've learned all about bookstores. And I was, you know, I asked them all kinds of questions. Every time I give a talk at a bookstore, I talk about the importance of it. And then I spend time asking the staff, because I'm still learning. So that's enough about the bookstore, but I'm sure you agree with me, and I'm sure, I always say this too, I'm sure you won't leave without buying at least one book. That's part of the routine. Woody Guthrie, L.A., 1937 to 1947. You know, the origin of this really came when I put out a CD in 2008, and I joined BMI, which is a publishing company. In case any of my songs ever became famous, my daughters would be able to reap the rewards from it. And I don't know that that will happen. But in any case, I did that. And BMI had a special arrangement with the Woody Guthrie Archives to do research for scholars who wanted to do research on Woody Guthrie. So I signed up for it, and I won the fellowship. And so I was able to go to New York to the Woody Guthrie Archives, and I buried myself as much as I could, as much time as I could get away from work. And I learned a lot about Guthrie, and I got very excited about, in particular, about this aspect of Guthrie, which is that we probably, most of us have a view of Guthrie, this kind of iconic view of Guthrie. You know, we see him as the guy that rode the rails, you know, in the days of the Depression, coming out of the Dust Bowl and all that sort of thing, coming out of Okemah and Pampa, Texas. We know him for that. We know him for the intransigent radical, the person who put slogans on his guitar that said things like, this machine kills fascists. We know him for that. We know that he was very political, frequently associated with the Communist Party, and we know about that. We also know him as an iconic figure in the revival of the folk revival, which we usually attribute to Greenwich Village and frequently the early 50s, and we also know him as the person that Bob Dylan copied. I mean, if you know Bob Dylan and you followed him, you understand how he basically became Woody Guthrie. Only sang Woody Guthrie songs and dressed like Woody Guthrie and developed a whole persona like Woody Guthrie before he eventually broke out of it and went into other directions. And of course, all these people that followed Dylan and dressed like Dylan were dressing like Guthrie. And so those are the things we know about Guthrie. But I wanted to ask another question about Guthrie. Like, well, how did he get that way? I mean, how did that happen? And I found that there was a very interesting evolution of Guthrie. And I found that Guthrie came to L.A. in the spring of 1937 as a guy from the Dust Bowl who knew a little bit about Oklahoma and Texas, had some kind of crude, relatively unskilled guitar work, had done street corner songs and singing for tips and things like that. But had never really performed in really a serious way. And yet that's the same person who, by the time he leaves L.A. in 1940 and goes to New York, has a very popular radio show on the radio 2 times a day. He's making $20 a week, which was good money during the depth of the Depression. He's evolved from songs that he played on his radio show that were hill country songs, gospel songs, songs that everybody knew. He evolved from that into writing his own material. He started to write things apart from his music, and so his development and his musicianship improved, and so his musical development was really during this L.A. period, but also his political development. I mean, he came as a kind of a Dust Bowl Democrat. His father was a leader in the Democratic Party in Okemah, Oklahoma. Of course, the Democratic Party in Oklahoma was a party that was very much aligned with the Ku Klux Klan. African Americans, if they could vote, would vote Republican in those days. And there was a Socialist Party, so you had the Republicans, the Socialists, and the Democratic aligned usually with the Ku Klux Klan. And so he came from this kind of a background, but he was a populist. He was for the little man. But when he came to L.A. and he was introduced to political people, people on the left, people that lived around here, people that lived in Echo Park, etc., and on the West Side. And when he met people like that, he began to read more and study more, learn from them, and his politics began to take shape as we know them. And so it was in this Los Angeles period of time that his development really, really took place. And the impact of it, of L.A.'s impact on Guthrie was very important because, for example, he was introduced to people like Will Geer, you know, the actor, you know him from the Waltons. But before that, he was a radical, a communist, blacklisted, couldn't work anywhere, and a wonderful, very interesting person. And he befriended Guthrie and introduced him to John Steinbeck and other people during his L.A. period of time. He met Ed Robin, who was a correspondent for the People's Weekly, which was a daily newspaper for the Communist Party on the West Coast. And Ed Robin, kind of met Guthrie and was totally amazed by Guthrie, this sort of political okie. And so that was very important for Guthrie, introduced him to this whole group of people in the L.A. area, and Guthrie became very popular and was at, you know, every rally, every demonstration, every picket line, et cetera, that happened in L.A. So the impact in terms of politics and music on Guthrie was really important. Also, the impact and his understanding of race, particularly with respect to African Americans, developed in the L.A. period, because, you know, he came from Okemah, Oklahoma. I mean, he came from a place where racism wasn't just, you know, a question of microaggressions or a racist attitude or a, you know, racism was the law. I mean, segregation was the rule. I mean, lynchings happened and they weren't punished, and that was the way things were, and people used language and they talked about other people the way that they wanted to talk, and that's the way it was, and that's what he knew. He came to L.A. and he had some interesting experience which transformed his own way of thinking, moved him totally against some of his own prejudices and moved him to be a very solid opponent of any type of racism, as displayed in his music, in his writings, and in his own actions, often declining to do a show because they wouldn't let Leadbelly eat with the people at the before, and things like that. So music, politics, race, these were very important for Guthrie in terms of the L.A. impact on him. But he also left an impact on L.A., which is interesting. Partly it was the radio show. The radio show on KFVD became very popular among the population, the Dust Bowl population, you know, some 200,000 of whom moved to L.A. During the Dust Bowl years. And there they all came, you know. You've seen the views. They're all coming into L.A. on their way maybe to the Central Valley, but as Bill Devereaux, who can't be here with you tonight, will point out, like half of those folks that came in from the Dust Bowl went into the Central Valley, but about half of them stayed in the L.A. region and looked for work here. The radio show was very popular with them. I mean, when Woody started the radio show with his co-host Lefty Lou, a young lady, and they did these hill songs and these gospel songs, it was really, really popular. And even if you were poor, you could afford a radio, and you would listen to these shows. And all the letters were coming in, and it was the most popular show on the station, which is how we got $20 a week, which he split with Lefty Lou, whose name was Maxine Chrisman. What was important about this, particularly as Guthrie became more political and as he became known in the L.A. community, was that he became a kind of a persona of the Okie that hadn't existed to that point. I mean, people knew about these agricultural workers, but they didn't really know too much about it. Guthrie gave them a kind of a face that they didn't have before, and it introduced that persona to other people. He did it in his own way, and it was merged with the character of Tom Joad in Grapes of Wrath. Tom Joad, in some ways, fashioned after Woody Guthrie, Guthrie after Tom Joad, the kind of some similarities here. The political Okie was something that the political left in California had never seen before. They knew Okies and Arkies and Jayhawkers and Texarkanas, but they didn't know any ones that were political. The organizers in the Central Valley that tried to organize agricultural workers would say to you, Dorothy Healy and all the rest of them would say to you, it's relatively easy to organize the blacks. It's relatively easy to organize the Mexicans. But those Okies are really impossible because they're racist. They don't want to be with the Mexicans. They don't want to be with the blacks. And they tell us that, you know, don't tell us to be with them. We're Americans. And that was the view of the organizers. Well, Guthrie was something different. Guthrie took all these politics in. He refashioned them in a kind of an Okie way, in this Okie persona. And he would talk in this, you know, he would walk up to the stage with his clothes on and kind of fumbling around, and he would do this routine. But it would be very political. It was something very, very interesting. It was a very interesting persona. What I tried to do in my work was to trace this through in the longest piece of the book, to trace this through his music and looking at how his music evolved. And the political evolution that I just described to you can be seen in his music. And it can be seen as music by the fact that what Guthrie did was, in order to make a little extra money, he would type out the lyrics of his songs and mimeograph them and then staple them together and sell them for like a quarter or something. He would have maybe 25, 30 songs in a little song folio. And so he would do that and he would sell them. Well, then after a few months, he had sold them all. Now he had to retype it. So now he retypes them again. Collate some, maybe some of you did this. I used to do a lot of it when I was in the movement. And so they would put on another one. So I have three or four versions of folios that went out during the LA period between 1937 and 1939. Well, if you take the same song and look at it and look at the lyrics over time, you'll see that the lyrics change. He alters the lyrics because his own political consciousness is changing, and the lyrics reflect that. And I talk a little bit about that in some of the articles. There's a lot of other really great articles in the book apart from the ones that I've talked about. There's also something that there's a lot in here that no one's ever seen. A lot of the quotes are from songs that were unpublished. But we also have something that no one else has had, which is when Guthrie was in 1938. Guthrie was an artist. He was a sign painter. He was an artist. He was a cartoonist, and he did these cartoons that are all about the politics in Los Angeles. And in a little book that he had, full of really interesting. You can't really see him here, but you get a sense of these cartoons. He was very creative in the things that he did with art, and so we have some of that. So there's a lot in the book that's never been done before. And makes it what we feel a real contribution to the whole literature on Guthrie. Now, I mean, I didn't know that it was all those things that were said at the beginning because I didn't write that. But someone reviewed it and said that, what did they call it, a blockbuster? And I mean, it was a lot of really good stuff. Yeah. So I'm really glad we've got a blockbuster and all those other things they said about us. And it's really nice too. And it's nice to get together and talk to people about it. When you've worked on something for a long time, you always like people to talk to somebody about it. You know, I wrote a PhD dissertation once, and I went, and afterwards I was able to get two of the professors who reviewed it to go have a drink with me. You know, the other two were too busy. And then, you know, basically I never talked about it to anybody until I wrote it up as a book later on, and I had a few. But, you know, it's always nice to get together with people and talk. Let me see if there's any questions that anyone might have. And actually, let me introduce my Angel City Press folks. Why don't you get up and say hi to everyone, folks. So, Patty and Scott and Jim. Okay, and Angel City Press, you know, I mean, it's L.A.-based, Angel City Press, you get it. And so, you know, we had different options on where we could take the book. We wanted it to take to them because we knew they would do a beautiful job. We wanted to do them because we wanted a book that actually people might buy and put on their coffee table. And I hope they do, and I hope you do. Any questions? Yes.
So I know a little bit about him here because my parents were friends with the Robins. So,
oh, really?
Yeah. But it's really what I find interesting is the Woody's geography in Los Angeles and how it corresponds to like LA. So he hangs out in Topanga and Echo Park. And I just find that very interesting in terms of what Topanga and Echo Park represent nowadays.
Yeah.
And that this was happening back in the 30s. So I'm curious about that. If any other places that he really hung out in?
Okay. I mean that's a good question. Let's take that up. He hung out a lot in Echo Park because he hung out a lot at Ed Robbins' house, basically crashing at his house. You know, I mean, Guthrie's a guy that, I mean, as far as I know, lived in L.A. I don't think he ever paid rent in L.A. Okay? I mean, he crashed over all the time over at Ed's house in Red Hill or whatever they called Echo Park. And, you know, there's that book. What's that book called on Echo Park, The Bohemians or the...
Bohemian,
yeah. I mean, there's a whole chapter in here about it. It's a great book. I told my daughter she needed to read it because she lives there, you know, where all the musicians live. And so he lived there. And then, you know, I mean, the guy was really good at getting people to help him because you tended to feel sorry for Guthrie. I mean, everybody felt sorry for him. And they wanted to help him. He had that kind of ability. And so there was an Italian lady who lived next door to Ed. But she actually lived most of the time in Pasadena. And so... Guthrie said, well, maybe I can rent it from her. So she came, and she met with Guthrie, and Guthrie played her a few songs. I think she was an Italian anarchist, so they had something somewhat in common. And so he was able to convince her to let him stay at her house. But I don't think he ever paid rent. And so he stayed there for a while. He also spent a lot of time just crashing in downtown L.A. in Skid Row. It was cheap. He would hustle for tips. And when he worked for the People's World, their offices were right down there, right off Main. If you go now to 4th and Main, you'll see it's designated as Woody Guthrie Square because he hung around a lot there. And I was able to get Tom Gilmore, who owned the building on the corner to agree that and to not have any problem with the city. So it's there, and there's a plaque that talks about Woody Guthrie Square. So we did. So he spent a lot of time there. He would sleep in flop houses a lot. He also lived in Glendale. And he lived in Glendale, and I don't know, it was a converted motel. I mean, it wasn't very good, and that's where he brought his wife and his two, and then later three children, and that was in Glendale. So during the period that we worked on it, he spent time in those areas. Topanga comes later. Topanga comes in the early 50s when Will Geer moves back from New York to Topanga and buys property there. And then Guthrie comes and crashes with him in the early 50s in kind of a difficult set of circumstances because by that time he shows the serious effects of Huntington's chorea and he's greatly debilitated. Kind of a long answer, but anyway, he never did pay rent.
You, in the chapter that you talk about at the beginning, you mentioned some of the reporting and traveling that he did, visiting various homeless encampments and
yes.
people living along the Yali River. And so I mentioned Topanga and Tahunga there. Did he visit in the course of kind of researching and reporting to look at the homeless camps before he actually moved there to live?
I don't think he actually lived in any of those camps along the river, but I think he may very well have visited them. He did more visiting when he was with Will Geer, and they basically had an agitprop group, and they went around into the Central Valley, and they were really working more on organizing migrant workers. It was more connected with an organized campaign. He might go and stay. He might go and crash at a place and play and try to get some food and kind of crash in a place. But I don't think he lived alongside the river. And I don't know that he was in Topanga earlier than the early 1950s. Maybe he was. The L.A. River song, you know, which maybe I'll do when I play a few for you if you're still here. Talks about that and that the L.A. New Year's flood. He also visited a lot of the Hoovervilles, and I may even do one of those songs, which is the lyrics are in the book. It's unpublished. It's unrecorded. So if you hear it, it's be the only time you'll ever hear it. And he did visit those. And what was really impressive to him was that, you know, most of the Hoovervilles, especially in the Central Valley, were, you know, they were areas usually by dumps. Do you ever remember what a dump is? I mean, I grew up in Minneapolis, and we had a dump. You'd have to go out of town to get it, but it was a dump. And it was a kind of an important thing because if you really need something and you didn't have any money, you'd go to the dump. And you get it there. And that's what poor people would do. So they would live around the dump. So they would congregate there. And the dump was so easy to live around when you were really poor because you could get stuff for really cheap or really free. If you went at night, maybe you could get it free. And you could get stuff. And then when you had to leave and you couldn't bring very much, you could just leave all your stuff there because it would just go to the dump. It was right there. The dumps were very convenient for these kind of Hoovervilles. So he wrote a song about Hoovervilles. But what he found really interesting was that when Culbert Olson was elected governor in 1938, and Guthrie actually did some work on the campaign, which is interesting. And they put Carrie McWilliams, they put in charge of agriculture, the guy who wrote the books, you know, Factories in the Fields. And then they put Dorothy Healey from the Communist Party as the main person under him. So, I mean, you know, they all had good resumes. And so they set up these camps, these work camps, and they gave agricultural workers like a place to sleep, a place to wash your clothes, showers. They gave them places where they could wash the dishes, and they were totally blown away. They thought it was heaven. And Guthrie said, "This is socialism. This is what I'm for." So that juxtaposition of the Hoovervilles and the organized labor camps was very vivid in his thinking during this period of time. It's kind of a long answer, but that's it. Any other questions? Yes?
Which would be the best recording of most comprehensive currently available.
Of Guthrie songs? By Guthrie? Well, the last chapter of the book is a section that I wrote called Recordings, and that actually can answer this question. But basically, Guthrie's recordings are relatively limited. They were all done during the period from 1939 to 1949. The ones in 1949 are hard to listen to. He's already showing the debilitating effects of the disease. The earliest recordings were found in L.A. The recordings that nobody knew about were found in L.A. It's very interesting why they were there and how. They were found in L.A. by a friend of mine, Peter LaChapelle, who was working on his Ph.D. at USC in history. And Peter was talking to someone, and he said, oh, you know, I think that you should go to the Southern California Library on 6120 South Vermont. You should go to the Southern California Library and see if they have anything, because it's a left-wing library. Well, I knew about it because when I first moved to L.A., I went to this library because I heard about it. A friend of mine who came from Wisconsin was the person who organized the library. Well, it wasn't really a library when it began. It started in the early 1950s, and it started because the LAPD Red Squad was looking for communists, and the easiest way to find out if you were a communist was to look at your books. Looking at your books would tell a lot about your political orientation, and so a lot of people were worried because people then they would be questioned. Well, now I see you have Marx and Stalin here on your shelf. What does that mean? What, you know? So a lot of them started bringing their books to this guy that lived, this guy that had a warehouse down on Vermont. So all these leftists in L.A. dumped off all their books and stuff because they wanted to get them out of the house. And many of them never came and picked them up. So there they sat at Emil Fried's, you know, warehouse. And so some folks, including this friend of mine who I knew from when I was at Wisconsin, she, Sarah Cooper, they organized it into a library. So Peter was looking at the library and he came across someone said, oh, there's some really, I think there's something, some records of some of that may be something to do with Woody Guthrie. So he finds it. Here they are, these Presto records. Prestos were the precursors to record machines. I mean, they were machines that you could record on. They weighed about 300 pounds. They were big, monstrous things. But you could record on them. And Guthrie apparently went in 1939, went in and recorded four songs on these. And so those were found in Harry Hayes' records. Why? Because Harry Hay was the educational director for the Communist Party in Los Angeles in the 1930s, and he was an activist, and he had a music appreciation. He lived in Echo Park. He had a music appreciation thing in a sort of the People's College, which was for workers who never could go to college to go to these colleges taught by Marxists. You know, it was a counterculture college. It wasn't a real college. They had courses. And so Harry Hay had these music courses, and Guthrie must have been to one of them because he recorded these, and they probably sneaked into the radio station and recorded them. So there are four of these records. They ended up in Harry Hay's collection. Harry Hay, by the way, is an interesting person, very important in our history of our city. This is another aspect of, you know, Guthrie in L.A. Harry Hay was a homosexual, but he wasn't out as a homosexual. And when the Red Scare came, the Communist Party had a position where homosexuals that were in the party should leave the party because they were being picked up and questioned and forced to give names of other people. And so Harry Hay left the Communist Party. But all of the skills that he had learned in it, he used to start the Mattachine Society. And the Mattachine Society was the first organization in the country to organize for the defense of homosexuals. And so Harry Hay was a really interesting guy, and he ended up with all these Neillers, Woody Guthries. The other recordings are after that. Alan Lomax heard him play in New York at a Steinbeck farm worker support group rally, and he brought him down to Washington, D.C., and he recorded a whole slew of songs in about three or four settings. And then Lomax got RCA Victor Records to record him, and that was his next album. His album, because the first ones were really, they were really for archivists. They weren't really commercial, but the Victor ones were, and it was called Dust Bowl Ballads, and a lot of and that probably was the most famous one, and that came out. But it was only, I think they only did about 1,000 records, and they didn't reprint it. It wasn't reprinted until the 60s. After that, he recorded a lot of songs by Mose Ash in New York, and probably a couple hundred of those. Beyond that, there are some other recordings, some kids songs and some other things, but pretty soon he started to show the effects of Huntington's chorea, and his recordings weren't very good. I would look at the article that I wrote, and then you would probably buy the two collections. I mean, I would buy Dust Bowl Ballads, and then I would get the Ash ones if you wanted to. They're all available. There's about four CDs, and the three CDs, and then. No, four CDs, and then there's three of them from the Alan Lomax. Okay. So you want to hear a couple songs?
Yeah.
Okay. I never know which ones to do. You know, I have an album, and it is available. And I'm not when I'm outside of LA, I say, no, I'm trying to sell these CDs because I'm trying to raise enough money to get back to LA, which I can't really say today.
Get back to your bookstore.
Back to my bookstore. We close at 6.
Guthrie's in the backyard in Glendale, in the backyard of the house that he doesn't pay rent for. And the kids and the little kids and his kids are playing, and they're playing with the neighborhood kids. And he liked to play with kids. He's very childlike, I mean, in a lot of ways. And he could sit and play with kids all day. And so one of them said, "Woody, where are you from?" He said, "Oh, I'm from the Oklahoma Hills." Hey, I think I'll write a song about the Oklahoma Hills. So there he goes. And this is a guy that could write a song in like 20 minutes. This song is kind of interesting because Woody Guthrie wrote it, and like a lot of his songs, put it in a drawer. And he wrote it in 1938 or 39. And then in 1946, he heard it on the radio, sung by his cousin Jack, whose real name was Leon, but they called him Oak. And Jack was like a country, you know, like a more polished, like a Gene Autry type, you know. So he took Woody's song, and it was a number one hit. And the country stations, and so Guthrie said, "Well, you know," and so Guthrie had some legal work, and he got $1,000 out of it, which is totally the most he ever got out of anything he ever wrote in his lifetime. The song became number one. It was also recorded. It became a hit in the early 50s, after a lot of tough political arm twisting, became the state song of Oklahoma. It was hard to do with Guthrie's politics. Ever been to Oklahoma lately? There you go. You know. The commercial versions of the song took out the Indians, but I put him back in. Guthrie was really good at trying to list a lot of things. He's big on lists. He lists all the Indian tribes. But when they made the popular records, they were gone. But not in mine. Many years have come and gone since I wandered from my home. in those Oklahoma hills where I was born. Many pages have been turned, many lessons I have learned, and I feel like in those hills I still belong. Way down yonder in the Indian Nation, I ride my pony on the reservation, Oklahoma hills where I was born. Way down yonder in the Indian Nation, I ride my pony on the reservation, Oklahoma hills where I was born. But as I sit here today, I'm many a mile away from that place I rode my pony through the draw, where the oak and blackjack trees kiss the playful prairie breeze in those Oklahoma hills where I was born. Way down yonder in the Indian Nation, I ride my pony on the reservation, Oklahoma hills where I was born. Way down yonder in the Indian Nation, I ride my pony on the reservation, Oklahoma hills where I was born. Now my mind turns back a page to the land of the great Osage, Chickasaw, Cherokee, Creek, and Seminole, where the black oil rolls and flows and snow-white cotton grows in those Oklahoma hills where I was born. Oklahoma hills where I was born. So there you go. I always like the LA, the New Year's flood, because it's kind of the story about how part of the reason why they put the river in concrete prison, you know, the LA River, and people are trying to get it out of prison nowadays. So Guthrie wrote about it. One of the things about Guthrie's songs that he wrote for his radio show, it's really interesting to think about, is that the kinds of themes that he talked about were the kinds of things people were talking about. Why? Because it was a radio show. He wanted people to listen to it. He wanted them to write in. The more people that wrote in letters to the show, the more he was able to try to get more money from the owner. So he had an incentive to try to do stuff that people wanted to hear. But what are these songs about? They talk about things that are going on. They talk about unemployment. They talk about police brutality. They talk about homelessness. They talk about, you know, big rainstorms on, you know, wiping people out that live by the river. They talk about other things, like more pleasant things like love and even sex. In other words, they talk about the same stuff we talk about today. It's kind of interesting. There's a timeless element to it. I think that's good. And that allows you to take Guthrie's songs and, as I do, put them into with new melodies and make them, put them into a new reality. Here's the LA flood. My friends, do you remember on that fatal New Year's night, the lights of old Los Angeles flickering oh so bright, and a cloudburst hit the mountains and it swept away our homes, and 100 souls were taken by that fatal New Year's flood. While we were celebrating Happy New Year's Eve, we knew not that in the morning a thousand souls would grieve. And the water filled the canyon, and down the mountain rolled the wild Los Angeles River, the fatal New Year's flood. The little towns of Montrose, Glendale, Burbank too, from Flint Ridge to Tahunga, along the mountain blue, they all were swept like lightning, and down the mountain rolled the wild Los Angeles River, the fatal New Year's flood. Highways were blockaded, bridges were all down, our homes were torn up and scattered, and still the rain came down. So bow your head in silence, thank the Lord above, if you were not left homeless by that fatal New Year's flood. Hooversville. Guthrie always liked to play with words. Instead of calling a song the plural of Hooverville, a Hooverville, two Hoovervilles, you would think. But not necessarily. It's like a board of directors and two board of directors. No. A board of director and two boards of director. So Guthrie said, not Hoovervilles, Hooversville. Well, he may not be right. This song, you'll never hear it again. But the lyrics are in the book. Ramblin', gamblin', rickety shacks. That's Hooversville, Hooversville. Rusty tin and rattly sacks. That's Hooversville, Hooversville. At the mosquito end of a garbage dump, about 1,000 people slump. Down there where the big rats run and jump. That's Hooversville, Hooversville. Hooversville, Hooversville. Hot swamp steam in the old hot sun. That's Hooversville, Hooversville. Kids that don't know too much fun. That's Hooversville, Hooversville. Kids that sleep on the old wet ground and eat all rotten food they found, digging in the big old dumps around Hooversville, Hooversville. Hooversville, Hooversville. Well, maybe you didn't know, That's Hooversville, Hooversville. And maybe you never got to go to Hooversville, Hooversville. Yeah, maybe you ain't ever seen a little girl about 15 get sold for the price of a bowl of beans. And that's Hooversville, Hooversville. Hooversville, Hooversville. Well, a fella sure hates to live in Hooversville, Hooversville. I'm going to get the hell out the first chance I get from Hooversville, Hooversville. Because kids need 3 square meals a day, and a man needs honest work and play, and a woman will die if she's got to stay in Hooversville, Hooversville. Hooversville, Hooversville.
There you go.
I usually get asked to do this, and we have some song sheets. What's the most famous, what's the song that everybody knows by Woody Guthrie?
This Land Is Your
Land. And I like to let people see what it looked like the way Guthrie wrote it originally. And tell you a little bit about it. So, it's 1940. Guthrie's work in L.A. is kind of wrapping up. The shows are getting smaller. The audience is getting smaller. As we began to get closer to the Second World War, there was an agreement made between the Soviet Union and Germany called the Nazi-Soviet Non-Aggression Pact. And that had a big impact on the political situation in the U.S. and all over the world, because it drove a wedge between those people who were allied with the Communist Party and everyone else, and their liberal allies, basically. And so as that movement split up, you know, the whole movement, there was less for Guthrie to do. So Guthrie took his wife and kids, and he drove to Pampa, and he tried to get some work there and didn't really get much in Pampa, Texas. And so he left him there because Will Geer had told him if he could make it to New York, he could get him a job in Tobacco Road, because Will was starring in Tobacco Road. So Guthrie said, I'm going to go to New York. So he went to New York. Well, on his way to New York, wherever he was, he kept hearing the same song all the time on all the radios and jukeboxes and everything. And you know the song. It goes, God bless America, land. If you're old enough, you totally know it, right? And you can't forget it. And so there it was. And he was really tired of it. And Guthrie was very good at writing answer songs. Songs that provide an answer to another song. And so when Guthrie got to New York, he quickly sat down and wrote this song. And it was originally called God Bless America for You and Me. And these are the verses, and you can see it in his hand. He wrote it on February 23rd, 1930. He even tells he wrote it at the Hanover House. Original copy. And so this is the way Guthrie wrote his songs. If he didn't have a typewriter. He had very nice writing, by the way. You know, he was very artistic until he became ill, and then it was hard for him to control his writing. So, God Bless America for You and Me. Now, he put this album in a drawer someplace and never did anything with it. But later, when he was recording for Moe's Ash in 1945, he took it out. He was looking for more songs. He took it out, and he looked at it and said, what can I do with this thing? So he decided to change it. He crossed out God Bless America, and he put in This Land Was Made for You and Me. So it wasn't God Bless America. I think it was originally God Bless America for Me, But I think he changed it to God Bless America, and then he said, with this land, so this land was made for you and me. Then he took the first verse and he made it into a chorus. So now you have to sing the first verse as a chorus all the time. And it's one of these songs, there aren't too many, where the first verse of the song is a chorus. I mean, sometimes there are. I did a Bob Dylan one last night that was like that. Oh, Mr. Tambourine Man is that way. That's a curious thing. Then he edited it. He crossed out some line. He X'd out the bottom one, and he took out the fourth one down, too. He put a check next to it. And in any case, this is way that he edited it, as he made it into This Land Was Made For You And Me. He recorded it. I don't think he ever thought it was a very important song. It's kind of interesting. And I think that's true, because when he worked with Alan Lomax and Pete Seeger to put together a compilation of about 200 songs, songs that were sort of about political things, encompassing everything about American history, he included about 75 of his own songs. In the compilation, he wrote an introduction to every song in the book. You ever seen it? It's called Hard-Hitting Songs for Hard-Hit People. And they took it to the publisher in 1946, and no one would touch it because it was too political. It was only published in 1967. But it's really interesting that Guthrie threw in about 75 of his own songs and didn't include this one. Why? I don't know. Pete didn't think it was that good, but Pete found when he sang it that people really liked it. And Pete Seeger, because Pete Seeger was blacklisted, so he could only play in like progressive schools and colleges. So, you know, he went to places where there were progressive people, and they really liked it. And, you know, it has this really kind of seductive, it's not like most things Guthrie, it's not Guthrie's melody. I mean, he acquires melodies. He just writes lyrics. But it does have kind of a seductive melody, and it's very Guthrie in that he talks all about the land and how beautiful the land is, and he talks about how the people are real nice. But what's interesting is that the verses that he took out, that later it wasn't used in recordings, and now, you know, when we do it, we put them all back. So now, tonight, you get to put them all back. You get to put these verses back. We do have to sing the chorus all the way through, just to be consistent. So I'm going to put it in the key of C, and we're going to go. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island. From the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you and me. As I went walking that ribbon of highway, I saw lovely that endless skyway. I saw below me the golden valley, and I said this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you and me. I roamed and rambled and followed my footsteps to the sparkling sands of her diamond desert. And all around me a voice was sounding, this land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you and me. There was a high wall that tried to stop me. A sign was painted and said, private property. But on the backside, it didn't say nothing. That sign was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land, from California to the New York Island, from the redwood forest to the Gulf Stream water, land was made for you and me. When the sun was shining and I was strolling, with the wheat fields waving and the dust clouds rolling, a voice was chanting, as the fog was lifting. This land was made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwoods Forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you and me. One bright sunny morning, in the shadow of the sea above, by the relief office, I saw my people. As they stood hungry, I started wondering if this land was really made for you and me. This land is your land, this land is my land. From California to the New York Island, from the Redwood Forest to the Gulf Stream water, this land was made for you and me. This land was made for you and me. There you go. Thank you very much. Thank you again to Skylight. Thanks to my publishers, Angel City Press. Buy at least one book. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Skylight Books author reading series. Don't forget, you can listen to this and all our other great podcasts at skylightbooks.com. Thanks again for stopping by, and we hope to see you soon.